council get situated. Next case is 11-1726, United States ex rel Black versus Health and Hospital Corporation. Mr. Coburn?
Yes, indeed, ma'am.
We'll be glad to hear from you.
May it please the court, I'm Barry Coburn, representing the appellant in this case, Paul Black, as your honor noted, ex rel, the United States of America. In essence, according to my understanding, what transpired below, the reason this case was dismissed and the reason that we're here today, is because the district court accepted an argument which was propounded, I thought, very expertly by HHC's counsel below, to the effect that all our client did, essentially all Mr. Black did, was to familiarize himself with a variety of publicly available information, information from congressional hearings, cases, press accounts, etc., and that he focused, the allegation below was that he had focused on a particular Medicaid funding methodology, which has been the subject of a significant amount of controversy, political controversy, in a variety of states and in Congress, and essentially utilized these very generalized sorts of concerns about what HHC and its counsel referred to below as, just to make sure I get the acronyms correct, UPL IGT financing. That's the term that was utilized repeatedly below. And that he essentially just parroted these concerns, just, you know, kind of molded them slightly into a quitam complaint in the hope that he would be deemed legitimately to be a relator and would achieve the financial reward which FCA accords to persons who successfully press such claims. The problem, as I understand it, is that despite the effectiveness of this advocacy below, and despite the fact that the district court allowed a broad-ranging argument, and certainly is a very able judge and was listening very closely, I thought, to the presentation that was made, the court erred in accepting this essential contention, because that is not what our client did. And the record on this is essentially, as I understand it, unrebutted. Certainly it's true, and I think there can be no controversy about the fact that to the extent there is essentially fact-finding that occurs in the motion to dismiss context in connection with the public disclosure bar and so on, that's reviewed for clear error. And to the extent that's what's at issue here, then our submission is and has to be that that's what we have here, is clear error. But, you know, we have an affidavit from our client in which he explains what he did. And what he did is not what was characterized below. It's essentially, as I indicated in, I believe, our reply brief, it's kind of the time-honored straw man technique of advocacy. You know, the notion is that this is an offensive thing for a relator to seek to do in order to, you know, kind of assume the mantle of a private attorney general just by, based on public information. But here, the record, as I understand it, is unrebutted to the effect that he did not rely, the crux, and certainly it's there can't be any controversy about the notion that he's allowed to read press accounts. I mean, the fact that he's aware of the 2007 attempt by CMS to amend its regulation, which turned out to be unsuccessful, That does not bar his claim. I mean, a relator does not have to close his eyes and, you know, refrain from watching television or something like that. What the issue here is, what's at the crux? What's at the center? You know, what is the centerpiece of the false claims allegation that's being made? And with respect to that, there is simply no controversy, as I understand it, about the fact that it is not drawn from publicly available information. It is not subject to the public disclosure bar because the sequence of events as delineated in the relator's affidavit are unrebutted. I mean, they're unambiguous and they're unrebutted. And I think, I mean, amidst the sort of just an extraordinarily voluminous alphabet soup of the documents that were submitted by both sides below, the thing that's most important from my point of view in this case is the relator's affidavit, which is, appears at the very end of volume one of the joint appendix. And in the affidavit, the relator says quite clearly that he doesn't pull this out of a press account. What's applied here is the subjectivity analysis, the pre-2010 analysis under the public disclosure bar that the Fourth Circuit, from our point of view, is very correctly applied under the Siller case. He first becomes interested, if you will, or engaged in this matter because of a client. I mean, he states quite clearly in his affidavit that in 2003, and this is paragraph 4 of his affidavit, page 496 of the joint appendix, says in 2003, a client that leased properties to some nursing homes in Indiana forwarded to him a letter it had received about assigning the leases to a wholly owned subsidiary of Indiana County, and that this would somehow allow the state of Indiana to claim more reimbursement for its nursing homes. Now, that is essentially a non sequitur, and so it didn't make any sense to Mr. Black. And that was the thing that caught his attention, not some sort of publicly available information, but that. And from there, he educated himself. And this is exactly, from my perspective, precisely what the False Claims Act is designed to encourage, because to the extent what it does is it appoints all of us as potential private attorneys general. This is the first thing you want a private attorney general to do is investigate. And that's what he did. He learned information from the individual he identifies as Bob Decker. We're still on page 496 of the joint appendix. He learns additional information from another individual, a Ms. Laird, Faith Laird, who he identifies, gathers information from these individuals, and becomes aware of a series of documents which are identified in the affidavit and in great detail in the First Amendment complaint, which are non-public. This is non-public information. He cites, you know, with a very high degree of specificity, emails. His allegations are predicated, I'm sorry, I just need to find the right page, but they're predicated on what he refers to as the secret agreement. And there's really no dispute about this. And here we're on Joint Appendix page 120, the secret February 20, 2002 agreement between OMPP and HHC. So it's predicated upon that. It's predicated upon, you know, the argument here is made, as I understand it, that all that we really have here is some sort of a misunderstanding because reimbursement under Medicaid to states is not based upon actual expenditures, but rather based on a statistical delineation of sort of prospective expenditures and so on. And these are the UPL expenditures in particular. That doesn't meet Mr. Black's allegations at all. That's not what he's saying. He's not saying that, you know, there's some distinction, some relatively small distinction between what Indiana might be allowed to claim prospectively, statistically, as opposed to its actual expenditures. He says, just as clear as a bell from my point of view, that with respect to these UPL funds that Indiana received, it doesn't spend them on patient care at all, not at all. And there's the crux of it from my point of view, because we're not talking here about something that is kind of drawn down from press accounts about glitches in the Medicaid reimbursement system. Here what we have, as I read his allegations, and to the extent it's helpful to the court, I just wanted to let the court know that there's a tremendous amount of verbiage in this case below, just really enormous. The crux of it appears in just a few pages of the joint appendix, to the extent it would be helpful to review them. And they are on joint appendix pages 112 through 117 and joint appendix page 120 through 127. That's where it is. It's right there. And it's just, it's really rather elegant and simple. And to the extent it's possible to pare away a lot of the rest of it, I think it's helpful to the analysis to do that. Because, you know, what we have here is a situation in which there's essentially a secret agreement between these two entities. And pursuant to this secret agreement, forms are being filled out which are just flat out unambiguously false. This is the CMS Form 64 that's referenced. And based on that falsity, reimbursements are being made for funds that are not being used, as I said earlier, at all for patient care. From my point of view, I'm not sure how that claim could be dismissed. I mean, it's almost like saying because there are press accounts out there about fraud being endemic amongst contractors in the defense industry, contractors who do business with DOD, provide services to DOD in exchange for compensation, that a relator comes forth and says, well, I've got one particular contractor who committed fraud in one particular manner, and here are a series of documents and internal emails and other non-public information relating to that particular species of fraud, and one were to conclude, well, that's barred by the public disclosure bar because there's information out there about fraud being endemic in the defense industry. I mean, I think that's really the analogy that we're dealing with here. And my submission to the court is that given the extraordinary degree of specificity that is set forth below, given our client's affidavit, uncontested affidavit, given the documents that he's submitted that are a litany of them that are attached to his First Amendment complaint, there's simply no basis for a dismissal here. The case should have been allowed to go forward. Certainly, there would be a motion for summary judgment following discovery, and if the appellee can prevail therein, then so be it.
I guess, Mr. Coburn, part of my challenge is your client's an attorney, and he says at one point, in my gut, I knew it was, it's just very difficult, as I know you appreciate. What's legal? What's factual? What's inferential? What did he know? It's like he embarked on this sort of investigation as an attorney. I guess I'm not being very coherent.
Oh, you are. But I know exactly what you're saying.
So where's the fraud?
Well, let me concede first in response to your honest question that I also focused on that phraseology, that I knew it in my gut. I thought that was really a very unfortunate sentence. And I personally would not have phrased the affidavit that way, but I don't think it matters substantively, is my submission to the court. I don't think what Mr. Black knew or thought he knew in his gut is frankly of any significance.
Except it's in the affidavit.
It's in the affidavit. Yeah. It's an unfortunate little bit of surplusage in the affidavit. And my submission to Your Honor is that that's all it is, just surplusage. And, it's essentially Mr. Black kind of telling the story in a manner which I would submit is just sort of too colloquial. It shouldn't have been used that way.
Okay.
But in terms of where the fraud is,
yeah,
that's
and
really...
And I'm trying to focus you on the 12B6, 9B.
Yes, indeed. And that's the crux of it from our point of view. Because to the extent, if what Mr. Black did... was to say something along the lines of, there are general problems out there with respect to Medicaid reimbursement, with respect to UPL, IGT methodologies, that the 2007 amendment to the CMS regulation that CMS sought and that Congress ended up essentially discarding, that should have been granted, and that, you know, the federal government is taking a bath on Medicaid reimbursement with respect to the state's share and so on. I mean, that's not a qui tam case. If that's what he did here, and that, I think, is in essence what the district court, my submission is, erroneously concluded that he did. If that's what he did, there's no way that someone who makes allegations like those is entitled to relator status.
So tell us, in the few minutes you have left, you have some rebuttal, but why isn't that what he did?
In order to do that, Your Honor, and I'm going to do this as quickly and economically as I can, he refers very specifically to a number of things. He says and he's referring to a state plan amendment, which admittedly is public, but it is background. Says that's essentially kind of the first step in the conspiratorial conduct that he identifies. And he says that the purpose of the state plan amendment was not what is reflected in the face of the state plan, but rather to implement the scheme that I just described. He refers to his attachment C and attachment E, attachment E being that secret 2002 agreement between OMPP and HHC that I referred to. This is a non-public document, as I understand it, signed by a couple of the individuals who he named in his complaint. And in it, he alleges that HHC agreed to falsely certify in a February 6th, 02 document, which is Exhibit A to that document, that its funds, and he states the amount, $3,889,000, were eligible for FFP reimbursement and could be utilized as the state's share of Medicaid expenditures for non-state governmental nursing facilities for a particular period in fiscal year 2001. And the point is that with respect to these claims for reimbursement that the state of Indiana makes, they are not being used for patient care.
And why is that fraudulent?
Because of it's fraudulent in particular because of the Form 64, the CMS Form 64 that has to be executed, which essentially says that those funds are going to be used for patient care. I mean, that's the whole thrust of the Medicaid reimbursement scheme, after all. Anyway, that they're supposed to be used for patient care. His point is that they're not being used for patient care at all. That's the crux of it. So you've got an unambiguous false assertion that has been executed and signed, saying one thing, and the reality, which is another. And this is a sort of a garden variety fraud allegation, which from our point of view, the district court never quite gets its hands around because it is focused on this notion of, you know, kind of a broad policy issue. But that's not what he's talking about. He's not talking about a broad policy issue. He is talking about something highly specific to this case. I just note that my time has expired.
All right. Thank you. You've got some rebuttal time left.
Thank you so much.
Ms. Ellsworth. Tell us why Mr. Coburn is incorrect and the district court was correct.
Sure. Good morning, Your Honor.
That is your purpose.
It is. Jessica Ellsworth on behalf of Health and Hospital Corporation of Marion County. The district court's decision below offered three independent and separate reasons why the complaint in this case should be dismissed. One was the public disclosure bar, which Mr. Black's attorney has been discussing with you. There was also a ruling that fraud was not pled with particularity under Rule 9b, and that the legal theory underlying the complaint was not a viable legal theory. Each of those three grounds provides an independent basis for this court to affirm, and I think all of them were correctly decided. Starting with the public disclosure bar, the district court made three factual findings about its jurisdiction under the public disclosure bar. And there is no basis for this court to conclude that all three of those factual findings were clearly erroneous. The court should have be left with no firm and definite conviction that there was an error here. The first finding of fact was that there had, in fact, been a public disclosure. As the district court noted, it has been very public all along that Indiana has been making supplemental Medicaid payments to county-owned nursing facilities. That is stated on the face of Indiana's state plan amendment to its Medicaid plan, which CMS approved in 2001 and again in 2007. It is actually a matter of Indiana law. There's a statute that requires maximizing federal funding through use of intergovernmental transfers and similar accounting mechanisms. There was, in fact, an audit that the Office of the Inspector General did of the UPL, the supplemental Medicaid payments to county-owned nursing facilities in Indiana. And in conducting that audit, the Office of the Inspector General looked at the UPL calculations, looked at the UPL payments, and looked at the underlying documentation and concluded that all of those payments during the 2001-2002 time period were in fact correctly made. And that's the time period that Mr. Black claims to have documents to support his theory for.
How does that work into what Mr. Coben recited as his factual basis for fraud, which is, I think that was also what he argued in his brief, that there is some fraudulent element when the reimbursement payments are not directly tied to patient expense?
This is, I think, where we get to the 12B6 part of the district court's ruling and whether in fact there is any legal basis for that assertion. In fact, UPL payments, the supplemental Medicaid payments, are additional payments that a state is authorized to make to certain categories of providers for certain categories of services, and there is an aggregate cap on those payments that can be made at the Medicare reimbursement rate, because Medicaid generally reimburses providers at a lower rate than Medicare does. So these UPL, the supplemental payments, are authorized if a state is willing to fund the state portion, which it can do through either state or local dollars, then the federal government will provide matching funds. There is no obligation to track how those UPL payments are spent. There's no obligation for a provider who receives them to use them in a particular way. These are reimbursements for past services that are provided under the prospective payment system. And so the provider's actual costs in providing those services are not a relevant consideration to whether the UPL payment is properly made or properly received. The reasons, the pros and the cons of these UPL payments, the supplemental payments, are because there are pros and cons, that's why CMS, Congress, the Office of the Inspector General, the GAO, have had an extensive public debate for more than a decade about whether this is a good or a bad policy to allow these payments to be made.
So you would, am I correct to say that your response to Mr. Coburn would be, even if we assume everything that you recited was correct, it doesn't make any difference because that's what the law provides and that's part of the public policy debate that's taken place and probably will continue?
That's right, Your Honor. And the 2007 proposed rule that CMS offered would have imposed restrictions on how these UPL payments were made or used. And after CMS proposed that rule, Congress actually, in a bill that it passed, put a moratorium on CMS's ability to finalize that rule in 2007, and then again in 2009, indicated that CMS should not finalize that rule. So those limitations that continue to be part of the public policy debate are simply not part of the current law as it relates to how UPL payments can be made or used. And that, again, relates to the legal viability, which was the district court's third rationale for dismissing this complaint. If I can just speak briefly to the public disclosure bar, the second factual finding that the district court made was that Mr. Black had based his complaint at least in part on the public disclosures. And if you look at Mr. Black's declaration, which my opposing counsel has referred you to, his declaration expressly states that he looked at that 2007 proposed rule and used it to help him articulate his complaint. This court has made clear that even partial reliance on a public disclosure is sufficient to trigger the bar. It's in the case, I believe is pronounced Viuru, and also in the recent Jones decision, U.S. X. Rel. Jones, that issued from this court last month. The third finding of fact.
When was it that the 2007 proposed regulations were rejected or withdrawn?
The 2007 proposed regulation had two main components that I think are relevant to this case, one of which was it would have required providers who receive UPL payments to retain the full amount of that payment themselves so that they couldn't transfer any of those funds or use another accounting mechanism to deal with those funds. The providers would have had to actually keep them themselves. And then also state and local owned providers would have been limited to receiving only their actual costs. So if a provider's actual costs exceeded the Medicaid reimbursement rate, they could receive a supplemental payment up to their actual costs, but no further. In fact, neither of those restrictions have gone into effect, and those are the types of restrictions that Mr. Black's complaint is alleging are problematic here.
Well, maybe this is a better question for Mr. Coburn, but at the time the initial complaint was filed, I forget how many amended complaints there have been in this case, the 2007 regulations or their precursor had not been, the quietus had not been put on those as of that time. Is that actually correct?
If you're referring to the original complaint in this action, it was filed in 2008, so after that proposed rule had been announced and after the congressional moratorium. There were earlier complaints that were filed in district court in Indiana that asserted different theories of liability. They asserted an anti-kickback statute theory and something about provider-related donations, which were an issue that CMS was very cued into around the 2004 time period. And that was one of the things the district court noted, was that Mr. Black's allegations have morphed in sync with the way CMS's criticisms and complaints about UPL supplemental payments have come about. And so that was one more reason that the district court found it was simply not plausible to say that Mr. Black had not relied on these public disclosures, given that he acknowledged using one of them. On the original source question, this court, again in the Viuru case and again last month in Jones, made clear that merely having a suspicion that there might be fraud lurking somewhere out there is not a sufficient basis to entitle a relator to original source status. And the comment, Judge Davis, that you mentioned in the declaration where he says, I knew in my gut, I have this gut feeling that there is something fishy here. That's exactly the sort of suspicion that this court and every other court, frankly, has held is not a sufficient basis to grant someone original source status. It's also similarly a reason for the court's 9B ruling, because pleading fraud with particularity requires more than having some kind of speculation or hunch that there is something problematic out there. The reason we have 9B and the reason it applies to fraud actions is to serve a gatekeeping function and make sure that someone actually is a proper plaintiff to pursue a fraud claim and can actually allege the who, what, when, where, and how of a fraud, which Mr. Black did not and could not do in this case. If the court has any further questions, I'd be happy to entertain them.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Coburn, you've got some rebuttal time.
Thank you so much, Your Honor. If I could pick up on Your Honor, Judge Agee's question just now, which has to do with what was the original complaint and what did it encompass? I think that is a critical question, and we devoted actually a significant amount of our reply brief. And here, again, just if I may be permitted, just by way of shorthand, we're referring to pages 6 through 8, it's really 6 through 10 of the reply brief, which are devoted right to that issue, because it is a critical one from our point of view, and there are actually two responses to it. First, and this is a bit of a diversion, I would submit, if you will, the attempted 2007 changes to the CMS regulations, which are referenced repeatedly in the Appellee's brief. And in fact, at one point in their brief, they say that our client used that proposed regulation as a, quote, template, close quote, for his allegations in this case. That is a very significant mischaracterization of what happened here. Our client, like I indicated earlier, was not required to sort of render himself uninformed. He's not required to close his eyes to the existence of, you know, this regulation and whatever
Except
significance.
Except that he does have the burden to exclude reasonable possibility that he relied on a publicly available source.
I agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think that's exactly right. And here's why I believe, specifically with respect to the 2007 CMS regulation, or attempted regulation, if you will, that he carried that burden. First, I mean, the most important thing is that the series of very specific factual allegations that I referred to in this case, that is to say the particular false statements, and he actually attaches some of them to his complaint, the emails, you know, the secret agreement and so on, all those things that I referred to, these are all completely distinct from the CMS regulation in 2007. Completely distinct. The CMS regulation 2007, it goes to policy issues. Here, he's not talking about policy issues. He's talking about just sort of really clear, unambiguous, overt false statements that were made in this case. More significantly, perhaps, even than that, and what I referred to earlier in those pages 6 through 10 in our reply brief, is that, and I think, Your Honor, Judge Agee, you were absolutely right to inquire how many complaints there have been in this case and so on. And as my opposing counsel correctly noted, the first complaint in this case, that is to say this case, which is from the District of Maryland, which is on appeal before this court today, the first complaint there is a 2008 complaint. But what's important here is that that's not our client's first volley, if you will. He first filed a complaint in Indiana in 2004, 3 years before the CMS amendment. And so he can't have considered the CMS amendment. It didn't exist. And the reason we devoted so much time to this in our reply...
There was a really robust public discussion about the issues during that period of time.
Indeed. That's absolutely right, Your Honor. There was and continues to be a robust public discussion about lots of issues relating to Medicaid reimbursement. The key distinction to be drawn, and the one that I'm hoping I'm able to draw here, is that that is not the crux of our client's allegations. He is not talking about public discussion, not talking about policy issues. He's talking about a particular, highly specific instance of fraud in this particular county, if you will, in this particular case in Indiana. And that's why we spent so much time talking about, you know, how he was in possession of this information, and it's reflected in the 2004 complaint in Indiana before the regulation ever came to pass. And moreover, even more importantly from my point of view, and this is actually addressed, I thought, very well by Judge Rakoff in the Huron case, which we submitted as supplemental authority to the court just actually earlier this week. That case explicates this issue in a highly literate and persuasive manner, from my point of view. And the notion being that a person can be aware, a relator can be aware of information like the CMS 2007 regulation, it does not disable them from being a relator because it doesn't go to the crux of this, it doesn't go to the nuts and bolts of the particular fraud that are alleged in that case or in this case.
Okay, well, you can finish your sentence.
That's all I have, Your Honor. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. We're going to come down.